We still don't know the whistleblower's name, he or she, but the 11.5 million documents and 2.6 terabytes of data, they leaked from the law firm Mossack Fonseca, based in Panama, aired the financial dirty laundry of the world's rich, powerful and untaxed, with fortunes hidden deep offshore. A team of investigative journalists from 100 media organisations, including the ABC, worked in remarkable secrecy to make sense of this mountain of data, the biggest single information leak in history. Their findings, the Panama Papers, were released in 2016, 10 years ago this month. For weeks, the papers were front page news around the world. The uproar was magnificent. Three prime ministers were forced from office. It seemed the grubby empire of international high finance would never be the same again. So, 10 years on, how much has really changed? Jared Ryle, director of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, who led the teams working on the Panama Papers, joins me from the UK. Jared, welcome to Late Night Live.
Look, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Jared, has anybody actually done a count-up of the number of books written and documentaries made about the Panama Papers?
We did that about 5 years ago, and we found that there'd been Hollywood movies made, race horses had been named after it, there'd been cocktails named after it, and lots of books, not just non-fiction books, but fiction books based on it.
Wow. But what was it the papers did? What did the papers show that hadn't been shown before?
I guess it really just showed the depth of the secrecy that these people were able to attain by going to offshore jurisdictions. And basically, I think we had 200,000 secret companies that were revealed. And some of the people who owned those companies were the rich and powerful, but also our politicians and heads of state and other people.
Well, one of the people who you exposed was Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, we found loads of offshore companies that had about $2 billion going through them, and they're all linked to this mysterious character in Moscow that we found. And we found that he was a cello player in an orchestra. And when we went to our Russian reporters about this, they told us that this person was a nobody. They'd never heard of him before. But it turned out that he was actually the godfather of Vladimir Putin's child. So that was the connection.
Godfather, how perfect. Now, of course, before publishing anything about anybody, you always have to approach them and give them a chance to put their case. You approached Mr. Putin?
Yeah, we went to the Russian reporters about when to approach Putin. I mean, we like to go through at least, because we apply the US rules, we like to give at least 3 weeks early with everybody, give them lots of time, because we, you know, there's often the chance that there's a perfectly good explanation for what we're revealing. And we want to get their point of view. But they begged us not to go to Putin too early. In the end, we kind of compromised. And we went 1 week before publication to the Kremlin. And immediately they called a press conference and denounced us.
So word was out about what you were up to.
Yeah, it was a kind of a pivotal moment in the whole investigation. We'd been working in secret for a year.
Without a leak,
nobody, one of the biggest rules we had was that no one was allowed to talk about their work, and we had to keep it secret, and everyone did, all the reporters. They were all working away quietly behind the scenes.
I found out some very good friends of mine were working on this, and they never let me know. They never told me.
Yeah, Four Corners were working away in Australia about this. There were, I think, 800 Australian names in the documents, and they were investigating them all the way through without saying anything to anyone.
Was magnificent. But Putin did bell the cat a bit.
Look, he actually did us a huge favour because, I mean, even with the biggest stories in the world, as you know, you have editors who are wondering, is this really as big as we think it is?
Yes.
And when 1 week out, Vladimir Putin or the Kremlin called this press conference and denounced what they said was going to be an information attack on Russia. And they named us in that attack. And of course, that sets the phones off. And immediately, anyone who had any doubt about the story no longer had any doubts. And of course, it set up an audience for our story the following week.
In a way, he vouched for you. But did he deny anything?
Look, he was one of the first leaders to come out afterwards and confirm that everything was true. His explanation for the $2 billion was that it was to be used to buy musical instruments. But I think at that point he realized that he wasn't the subject of what we were doing. We were actually looking at all these other world leaders, including many of his enemies, like Petro Poroshenko in Ukraine were named, and David Cameron, who was then the Prime Minister of the UK, was named. And once he realized that it wasn't just him, he was actually the first to come out and say, look, this is true, but here's the explanation for it.
A number of prime ministers resigned because of your revelations. Why did they resign, and why did others like David Cameron manage to hold on?
Well, it was the hypocrisy, I think, that really came through. I mean, the first Prime Minister de Gaulle was the Prime Minister of Iceland. He resigned, I think, within 24 hours of publication. And again, it was because we had discovered that he had a secret offshore company that was a creditor to the banks in Iceland that at the time had collapsed. And he'd been elected as the Prime Minister to sort out that collapse without telling anybody that he had actually had a secret financial interest in sorting it out himself. So he had to go. With David Cameron, it turned out that his father had a secret offshore company that had set up a trust that David Cameron himself was benefiting from. And this was important because in the context of offshore finance, David Cameron had been campaigning for a number of years to eliminate the secrecy in offshore jurisdictions. So, of course, that put him in a very awkward position. And there were like public protests in the UK about it. David Cameron was changing his story every day for the first 5 days of the revelations. And it turned out afterwards that he was on the verge of resigning over this whole thing.
What saved him? Gall? Shamelessness?
It's like most stories, if you wait long enough, it goes away. But, I mean, there's a lot of backstory to this. I mean, it's said that Putin was so angered by the Panama Papers, he still suspected that it was a US-led thing, that he then interfered with the US elections and with David Cameron. They're saying that, you know, because he was in such a crisis over this, it led to Brexit.
So this is 2016. This is Trump's election and Brexit.
Well, I think it just shows like the world affairs sometimes, you know, once you have these kind of revelations, you know, it has long-term impacts that people can't see for many, many years. I mean, we're still seeing prosecutions in relation to Panama Papers. There's an ongoing prosecution at the moment in Germany, 10 years later, with one of the main principals of the Mossack Fonseca company being prosecuted at the moment.
But in Panama, there were no successful prosecutions, I understand.
Well, the principals of Mossack Fonseca, the two main guys that had set it up, Mossack and Fonseca, they both went to jail initially, but then they got out and there were lots of trials over the, you know, intervening years. But in the end, of course, they got away with it. One of them died recently. And the Panamanian government, they set up a commission of inquiry. They headed it with a Nobel laureate called Joe Stiglitz. And they said they were going to clean up their act in Panama. But then Joe Stiglitz resigned from that because he said they weren't really serious about doing it. It was all window dressing.
And so the act in Panama has not been cleaned up?
No, and the offshore world continues, but in a much more sophisticated way. I mean, they were caught with their pants down, I guess, if you wanted to put it that way, when we revealed everything. But now it's got a lot more sophisticated, but the same kind of shenanigans are going on. And it's not just about tax evasion. I mean, you're talking about sanctions, evasions here. You're talking about people, you know, drug dealers, criminals getting away with things, because what it allowed you to do was to have ultimate secrecy, complete secrecy. And when you breach that secrecy, that's when things start going wrong for them.
So how are things more secret now than they were before?
Well, I think what happened is there were lots of new laws brought into play. And in fact, most people would have been affected by this because it's now very difficult to open a bank account anywhere without having to give your true identity. Back then, one of the accusations against Mossack Fonseca is that they didn't even know who the clients were. They were just happy to open up these offshore accounts, which, you know, often were linked to bank accounts back in places like London or New York or other places. and they didn't really know who their clients were. Now, with thanks to Panama Papers, there's a lot of that secrecy has disappeared. Governments are insisting that banks and financial institutions know who their customers are. So we're all affected by it. But again, there are ways of getting around that. What we found in, when we continued to investigate this world is that clients were deliberately misspelling their names, for instance, to give the Mossack Fonsecas of the current world, they could legitimately say they didn't know who Vladimir Putin was if he misspelled his name.
But all you have to do is find a willing cellist, don't you, to front a hot fortune and send it through the banking system.
Well, that again was something that was brand new at the time. People didn't realize that when you are a powerful leader, you don't put these kind of accounts in your own name. You have people around you who do it for you. And what was fantastic about the documents is that they showed the entire paper trail of how this happened. And so you're able to, I guess, confirm what many people suspected, that there was one rule for the rich and one rule for everybody else. And here was the evidence for the first time. And that was the real shock here.
Has anyone been punished? Has anyone gone to jail for this?
Oh, multiple people have gone to jail. Even the Prime Minister, the then Prime Minister of Pakistan, was sentenced to 10 years in jail, but he got out soon afterwards and he's now back in power. Mossack Fonseca are out of jail, but there are a number of minor figures who were prosecuted. And in fairness, a lot of money was collected from around the world.
How much and who did it go to?
Well, the government's realized that this was a boon because we were naming all of their citizens that had offshore accounts. So they were able to knock on their doors and say, can you please explain why this is happening? And that happened in Australia too. I think the Australian government recovered about $100 million from the people that we named. And overall, we've now totted it up to $1.4 billion US. And I think that's a very conservative amount of money.
But some countries have cleaned up their acts, haven't they?
Not really. There was a lot of push to have this kind of information public. David Cameron, since 2013, had been pushing for, places like the British Virgin Islands, the former kind of Commonwealth countries, to make these registers, these offshore companies public. But it never really happened. I mean, there was a big push afterwards to make it happen. And all the countries, the smaller countries, just pushed back and said, no. This is our livelihood. We're not going to interfere with it. We're going to keep it secret. So, yes, there has been a lot of change, but there's also been a lot of non-change that should have happened.
Tell us about working with this mountain of paper. Now, this is pre-AI. Every page had to be read, no?
Yeah, and that was also very awkward. I mean, it started with a small number of documents when you think about it. So we ended up with 11.5 million documents, but the main source, we had two sources, but the main source was this character called John Doe, who was feeding the information to us, about 1 million documents a month, and we never knew when it was going to stop. It was actually very difficult to do, because what we had to do then was ingest the information into a system that allowed the journalists to look at the documents in a sophisticated way. And of course, every time we got a new set of documents, we had to start all those searches all over again. So you had to start searching for your prime minister. Is there anyone else you might have suspected were in the documents? It had to begin again. But we were also able to use a lot of machine learning. So once we realized a certain type of document was of great interest to the journalists, we were able to devise a method that would allow them to do that very quickly. So it was kind of the early days of machine learning or artificial intelligence that we were using.
How did you actually organize breaking the story? How was the game plan worked out?
Well, the game plan initially was looking at the documents that we did have. So we started with, we had an initial leak of 1 million documents from a previous source. So we knew that when John Doe appeared on the scene, that he was giving us real information, because one of the biggest fears you have as a journalist is that someone is putting in false information into big data sets, and then you end up with embarrassment or egg on your face at the end. But we knew from that first leak we had, that John Doe was the real deal. And so what happened, how we organized, is that we We set up a system that would index the documents and give access to the reporters from anywhere in the world. They could literally go from anywhere in the world into our system and search the documents. We then had a separate online newsroom where the reporters would see what they were seeing from the documents, but then they needed to talk about it to each other. And we did that using an online newsroom. And there were rules, simple rules. The first rule was that you couldn't tell anyone what we were doing until we were ready to publish. And the other rule was that we were going to publish together at exactly the same moment in time around the world.
And that's what you did.
Because we were getting the John Doe source came in through one of our media partners in Germany, Süddeutsche Zeitung. We had to get permission from them to do this. And of course, they initially thought that this could all be done very fast. So when John Doe appeared at the beginning of 2015, they thought, oh, this will all be done and dusted by September that year. But of course, it couldn't get done that quickly.
The bastard kept giving you more.
He kept giving us more to the point where we actually said to him, please stop giving us more because we have to start again every time. And in the end, we just cut it off at 11.5 million and we went for it. And to be frank, I mean, a lot of the really big names that came out were found near the end. A lot of the really hard work and the best work was done in the last few months of the investigation.
What was the response on the day of publication all around the world?
Initially, I think there was absolute disbelief. I remember I had arranged to break the story live on the BBC when I was in Washington. And I remember being interviewed that moment, and I could hear a shuffling of paper on the other side from the interviewer. And the questions weren't exactly the ones I was expecting. And I left the studio scratching my head thinking, well, maybe this story isn't as big as I think it is. And then I got a call from the producer apologizing because it had been a weekend and they had a weekend lawyer in who had just seen the material for the first time and had a heart attack and was changing the questions and watering them down as they were being asked to me. So I think the first reaction was one of total disbelief. Could this be true? I remember the New York Times carried the story on day one on page 3 with lots of questions. And on day 2, it was front page, because by then, of course, the Prime Minister of Iceland had resigned. People had surrounded the Parliament building in Iceland. They were throwing yogurt and bananas at the building, demanding his resignation. And from that moment on, it became probably, I won't say now, certainly the biggest story in the world.
How long was it on the front pages for? I mean, my memory is that it was for weeks, but it can't have been as long as that.
It was for weeks and for months. I remember 3 weeks later, I had to go to London for an event, and I picked up the Times of London, and they weren't one of our media partners, and it was the front page lead story, because by then we had released a lot of the information on a website, a lot of the names, and journalists were finding things, new things that we hadn't spotted. And one of them in this particular story was a very famous British actress who we had completely missed. So, even though you were working for a year, there were lots of things in here. It was so rich. There were so many things that we had missed ourselves.
And there must have been lawyers around the world having heart attacks. Did anybody sue for defamation?
No, we did have a complaint from the Prime Minister of Pakistan at the time, because in the editing of our story, we had our big revelation there was that his family owned, I think, 4 very upmarket properties in London. And in the editing, we had said that it was he himself who owned them, but it was actually his young children, which, of course, was much worse, which led, of course, then to the court cases in Pakistan and public protests there. But no, that was the only thing. I mean, it was very difficult to deny the story because we had the documentation. But also, it was very difficult to deny because we had 376 journalists from 80 different countries all looking at the documents and coming to the same conclusions. So, we were challenging ourselves for months and months online in this online newsroom, questioning, is this what we're really seeing? Is this what it really is? And when you have that body of people looking at something and coming to, it's really, really difficult afterwards to say, look, you got it wrong, because it's so many eyes on it.
Yes. Jared, 10 years after the event, congratulations again for one of the greatest scoops of all time. I've been talking to Jared Ryle, Executive Director of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. Jared ran the teams that produced the Panama Papers. Thanks for joining us on the show.
Thank you, David.
But I'm not going to leave without reading the honour list of Australian journalists involved. Sally Naber, Marianne Wilkinson, Elise Worthington, Mario Christodoulou, Morag Ramsey, Lisa Main, Sophia O'Rourke, Ali Russell, Stephen Oxley, Ruth Fogarty, Neil Chenoweth, Edmund Tadros, I think, Misa Han, Primrose Reardon, and Jonathan Barrett. You worked with them all, Jared?
And two more. You should mention we had Will Fitzgibbon from Tasmania working on the ICIJ team, and we had Hamish Baldenrutter from Sydney also on the ICIJ team.
Excellent. We've got the lot. Thank you very much for joining us on the show for this remarkable anniversary.
Oh, thank you, David.